Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening in. I'm here with engineer Mike Murphy and Anna Banana, who will be joining in a little bit later on this wintry first day of February. It will be partly sunny, but cold today, with temperatures in the mid-20s dropping down to the teens at night today and tomorrow. On Wednesday, we should see it get above freezing with some rain at night, but by Thursday, snow is expected to return. On Friday, the sun should return, but with temperatures starting to drop all the way down into the single digits by the weekend. Saturday night is expected to go below zero, and winter is still here, folks. By the way, I was looking out the window the other day at our wintry and white backyard, and lo and behold, a fluffy, bright red fox ambled through the snow. A really spectacular sight. Okay, let's get to the news. I heard the news last night of the takeover of Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, with the military taking control of the country and with many of the country's senior politicians, including the country's president, and Aung San Suu Kyi, who is kind of the leader of the country, being detained. Central Executive Committee members, lawmakers, and regional cabinet members were also taken into custody. So this was on the day of the country's parliament was supposed to begin. And reasons cited were allegations of voter fraud and in the last election and failure to postpone the last election due to the pandemic. So no doubt we'll be hearing more from that soon. And I think the thing I want to say about that is that, what happened here in the United States is nothing compared to what's happening in Myanmar. But it did give me a sense of how disruptive it is for everybody when these things happen. And I just have to think about the people in Myanmar and you know, the stress they're going through compared to, you know, the stress we all went through in January. So anyway, that's Myanmar. We'll hear more about them. And now is Dennis Hart with Iowa News.
The ongoing coronavirus pandemic and that big snowstorm that blew through the state all made big news around Iowa last week. First, the snowstorm. It blew through Iowa last Monday and Tuesday, bringing almost 13 inches of snow to Des Moines and Ames and more to other cities and towns. The snowfall broke a 126-year-old record in Des Moines, and it was only the second time the city had received 10 or more inches of snow on any January 25th. In Adair and Pleasant Hill, more than 14 inches of snow fell, while Urbandale received 13 inches. A number of flights at the Des Moines International Airport were either canceled or delayed. Des Moines police responded to dozens of vehicle crashes and reports of vehicle stalls and injuries. The Iowa State Patrol reported about 300 calls for assistance from drivers. Some central Iowa schools, including Ankeny, Johnston, and Southeast Polk, canceled classes, while others started late on Tuesday because of the snow. In Ames, students were told not to come to in-person classes, but to take part in classes remotely. Now, the coronavirus. The number of deaths caused by the virus in Iowa continued to go up last week, exceeding 4,900 by yesterday afternoon. The number of people infected by it also continued to rise, approaching 320,000 by yesterday. Three of those who tested positive work at the Iowa State Capitol. One of them was State Representative Amy Nielsen of North Liberty. Meanwhile, word last week that coronavirus vaccination teams had reached nearly all of Iowa's nursing homes, giving at least one round of shots to thousands of the state's most vulnerable residents. 98% of Iowa nursing homes had been visited at least once by vaccination teams, mostly from CVS or Walgreens. The vaccination teams were set to reach the few remaining nursing homes last week. Nursing home residents make up less than 1% of the state's population, but they have accounted for more than 40% of Iowa's deaths from the coronavirus. At the same time, there was a report that nearly half of the state's prison employees had refused to take the coronavirus vaccine, in spite of attempts to educate them on the vaccine's benefits. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said last week that the state can expect more doses of the coronavirus vaccine soon, but the demand still outstrips the supply. The governor said President Biden's announcement that the federal government would secure an additional 200 million vaccine doses equates to about 6,300 more doses of vaccine a week for Iowa for at least the next 3 weeks. That would bring Iowa's weekly allotment of doses to nearly 26,000 per week. Starting today, Iowa will expand the eligibility for vaccines to include emergency responders, teachers, and those aged 65 and older. But leaders in Polk County and other Iowa counties warned that their supply of any coronavirus vaccine would remain far below demand for at least several more weeks. In a related story, word last week that the CEO of the Prairie Meadows Racetrack and Casino said his staff had repeatedly reached out to Governor Reynolds, the state's congressional leaders, and local officials to pitch the idea of opening a mass coronavirus vaccination center at its Altoona facilities. But CEO Gary Palmer said all he's heard is that no one knows if there's enough vaccine to do it. And last week, the governor said she would not apologize for how her administration handled the deployment of coronavirus testing teams last year, in spite of reports that showed the state arranged testing at businesses associated with some of her top donors. A post in the blog Bleeding Heartland said emails showed that GMT Corporation in Waverly received testing last May. GMT is a parts manufacturing company that is partially owned by Republican donor Bruce Rastetter. Governor Reynolds said any criticism of preferential treatment is unjustified. There was also word last week that Iowa lawmakers were considering asking dentists to administer coronavirus vaccine shots. The proposal received its first hearing at a state House subcommittee last week, but it did not advance. Lawmakers said they wanted more time to consider the measure before making a decision. If it became law, dentists would be required to complete 4 hours of training related to prescribing and administering vaccines. In other news last week, word that Polk County Treasurer Mary Maloney had died. She had been county treasurer since 1989 and had been elected 7 times to that post. On the state legislative front last week, the Iowa House of Representatives approved a constitutional amendment saying the state constitution does not protect abortion rights. The measure passed on a 55-44 vote. Republicans argue it would counter what they called the judicial overreach of an Iowa Supreme Court decision that affirmed abortion rights. Democrats said it would open the door to extreme restrictions on abortion. The measure is likely to pass the state Senate this year, and if that happens, the legislature would still need to approve the language of the anti-abortion amendment again in 2023 or 2024, before it could appear on state ballots in the 2024 election. Also on the legislative front last week, Iowa House Republicans advanced a bill that would require doctors to provide women who seek medication-induced abortions information about reversing the pill's effects, information that critics say is unproven and scientifically disputed. The bill would require doctors to give patients information about the risks associated with a medication-induced abortion, then notify them that it may be possible to reverse the intended effects of the medication abortion if the woman changes her mind. And state lawmakers passed a bill last week that mandated that Iowa schools offer 100% in-person instruction. The bill gives schools 2 weeks to develop that option for students. Parents can decide to send their children back to school full-time or remain in a hybrid or online program. Governor Reynolds had asked for that bill from the legislature during her condition of the state address last month. She signed it into law this past Friday. Also last week, the governor released an education plan under which some students would qualify to receive public funding to pay for their education at private schools through a new scholarship fund. The governor's plan would also widen the number of students eligible to open enroll in other schools and allow groups to form charter schools without applying through their local school district. And last week, word that both state legislative houses had voted in favor of a state constitutional amendment that would protect residents' rights to have guns. That vote cleared the way for residents to vote on the issue in 2022. If a majority of Iowans vote in favor, that amendment would be added to the state constitution. And the governor said she would seek legislation that sets a renewable fuel mandate in Iowa, requiring that motor fuel sold in the state contain at least 10% ethanol and 11% biodiesel. Iowa produces the most ethanol and biodiesel in the nation. About half of Iowa's corn crop, which is the biggest in the United States, is used to make ethanol. Iowa is the second biggest grower of soybeans, which are used in biodiesel production. There was more last week on the legislative front, including a bill that was introduced that would give parents the right to request that their children be held back a grade in an effort to help students who have fallen behind academically. If it becomes law, Iowa would allow parents or caregivers to submit written requests before August 15th to hold children from advancing during the next school year if they feel their children did not progress enough academically during the current school year. And a state Senate subcommittee advanced a plan that could, if neighboring states cooperate, make daylight saving time last all year in Iowa. And while all this was going on, Republican Adrian Dickey won the special election held last week to replace Marionette Miller Meeks in state Senate District 41. Dickey defeated Democrat Mary Stewart by 1,000 votes out of the 9,000 votes that were cast. Miller Meek stepped down from the state Senate seat after she was confirmed the winner in Iowa's 2nd congressional district race. In other news last week, Prosecutors accused lawyers for murder suspect Christian Bahena Rivera of illegitimately subpoenaing information about Molly Tibbetts. The University of Iowa student Bahena Rivera is accused of killing in 2018. Bahena Rivera is scheduled to stand trial for Tibbetts' murder May 17th. In a related story, the Federal Communications Commission fined a Montana man nearly $10 million after he sent racist, anti-Semitic, and harassing robocalls to tens of thousands of phones across eight states. Scott Rhodes used Molly Tibbetts' death, among other high-profile topics, to promote a white nationalist message in a robocall campaign. Tibbetts' family members were among those who received the calls just days after she was found stabbed to death. Also last week, the route for this coming summer's Ragbri, the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride across Iowa, was announced. The ride will take place July 25th through the 31st. It will start in Lamar's and end in Clinton. Last year's ride was canceled because of the coronavirus. And last week, word that the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake, where Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and JP the Big Bopper Richardson had given their last performances before the plane crash that took their lives, had been designated as a National Historic Landmark by the U.S. Department of the Interior. And a couple of more notes before I go, and they're about two great film and TV actresses who were born in Iowa. Last Wednesday officially was Donna Reed Day in the state, named for the Iowa-born farm girl who went on to win an Academy Award for her work in the movie From Here to Eternity, but who was perhaps best known for her work in the legendary It's a Wonderful Life, and for the TV show that bore her name. Donna Reed died in 1986. She would have been 100 years old last Wednesday. And there was word last week of the death of Cloris Leachman, who was born in Des Moines and who went on to become an Emmy and Academy Award-winning actress. Cloris Leachman was best known for her role as Phyllis Lindstrom in the legendary 1970s TV situation comedy The Mary Tyler Moore Show and its spin-off, Phyllis. She won two Emmy Awards for that role, but won six more primetime Emmys in both comedy and dramatic roles. She also had great success on the big screen, winning an Oscar in the movie The Last Picture Show. Cloris Leachman was 94 when she passed away last Wednesday at her home near Los Angeles. And that is your summary of quite a week of news from all around Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, taking my leave now, but already planning my return to this same virtual seat this coming Friday, when I'll have word on what makes news in Ames. Between now and then, stay safe and stay healthy, as we all try to make our way through a new month in this new year.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring, ring with the harmony of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high as the glistening skies.
This is Local Talk. I'm your host for the hour, Ursula Rudenberg, and that was Alicia Keys with Lift Every Voice and Sing, otherwise known as the Black National Anthem. February is Black History Month, and we will be bringing you programming to honor and explore that throughout the month. However, February also has another significance for an important local institution, Access, the Assault Care Center extending shelter and support, was founded in February 45 years ago. Access is celebrating its 45th anniversary with a project they call Accessing Our History, a concerted effort to document the history of the organization. They are tracing the historic the stepping stones and the historic landmarks that built Access and the people that built it into the service that it is today. So what better way to commemorate this anniversary than to kick off February with Tess Cody, the Executive Director of Access, and Courtney Palmersheim, Development Coordinator and Producer for Accessing Our History Project. Welcome, Tess and Courtney. It's good to have you with us.
Good morning.
In unison. Okay. Before we get started, I'd like to advise you, the listener, that our conversation will involve sexual assault and domestic violence, and these topics can trigger emotional responses. Before we get into the Accessing Our History project, Tess and Courtney, could you please describe exactly what Access is for anybody who's not familiar with Access, and tell us what you do?
So Access Assault Care Center, we provide support services to survivors of sexual abuse, domestic abuse, and homicide and other violent crimes. At our heart, we're an anti-violence organization, and so that looks like accompanying people as they make reports to different systems. It could be a school, law enforcement, helping people figure out how they can keep themselves safe, keep their family safe. That might be through emergency shelter or just a really solid safety plan and troubleshooting. Our job is to hear out survivors and help them meet the goals and things that they need to recover from trauma and make their life what they want it to be.
And tell us exactly why this is a historic moment. Give us a little bit of sense of why this project that you're doing right now came about, Accessing Our History project.
Yeah. Well, I have to just take one quick moment to acknowledge it's interesting to be asked, why is this historic, when I'm sitting here with our founder. Ursula helped found this agency 45 years ago, and that's not lost on me that there's something beautiful and amazing about getting to look back at our history with you specifically. And I think just the thoughtfulness and understanding that this project has had because we've gotten to do that with you has been amazing. So there's that first bit of recognition. I would also...
Full circle moment, right? Full circle moment.
It is a full circle moment. It's also historic because I think that just recognizing that throughout our history, across all the decades we've existed, survivors have built this agency. And there's something really amazing and powerful as you start to realize, have that kind of come into light, how the agency developed over time, and that the decisions we're making today about how we serve survivors are informed by the lessons we learned over time, even if they weren't explicitly named. And then the other thing that I know, at least for me, has been really powerful with this project has been just recognizing that we're in a complex national moment where, in recent years, survivors have been so vocal, willing to be brave and share stories through the Me Too movement. And at the same time, as a country, we haven't always been able to fully hear them out and know what to do when they speak up. And I think there's something really powerful of pausing and saying, these are stories about hearing survivors out and the real impact that that can have. So those are the first things that came to my mind. We could spend a whole bunch of time just on why is it historic that a sexual assault agency is turning 45 and the kind of unifying power that that has. But those are just a couple of the top line things that come to my mind.
Well, the good news is that nobody is really asking anymore, why the heck do we have this in the first place, right? I mean, why do we have a center like that? I think that's one of the things that came out. when we were exploring the history is that that transition from asking why is this even necessary to, you know, to accepting the reality of sexual violence and abuse.
It's easy to forget that movement change has happened in 45 years, especially when you're in the day to day of seeing that hurt still happens, mm-hmm. but change has happened.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, actually, KHOI partnered with Access for this project, Accessing Our History, one part of the project, which is the oral history part. We we recorded a lot of oral histories here in the studios at the radio station. But Courtney, tell us a little bit about the project. Just what are the about, you know, what are the goals of the project and what are you actually doing?
Yeah. So at its core, Accessing Our History is a storytelling project, like you've said. In 1976, Access was founded, but in the 45 years that we've been serving survivors, we've changed quite a bit from expanding our reach to 4 additional counties into adding services like a 24/7 helpline and a shelter for victims and their families to come stay at. Accessing Our History just really aims to highlight all of those changes and the stories of past staff and volunteers and interns. In hopes of recording and documenting our history to live on forever, but also just to celebrate all those that helped us get to where we are today. And KHOI, like Tess said, has been so amazing in helping us record the stories that we'll be sharing and reflecting on this year. So today, we're kicking off Accessing Our History with a 45-day social media campaign over on our Facebook. It's at Assault Care Center. We're going to be sharing just short snippets of our history and testimonials. And we're so excited to be sharing the story of Access with everybody.
Yeah, and you know, what Courtney said about the reach of Access now is really significant. Access started as one telephone in my apartment here on Douglas Avenue, actually, one block away from where KHOI is now. And it literally was just that. And today it's an agency that reaches many counties. And this is a this is testimony to the work that many, many people have done. It's this has not been an easy organization to build. The topic is not a pleasant one. And many, many people have applied themselves to this. And we heard some of these people in the studio talk about their journey that became the journey of Access, too. And it really gave me a lot of respect for the many phases that the organization has gone through to be what it is today. Before we're going to hear a few of these clips and have you talk about them. But before you do that, Courtney, you are developing a page on the Access website as well for this project. Tell folks how they can find it.
Yeah, so our website is assaultcarecenter.org. And we just wanted to make sure that everything Accessing Our History had a place to live publicly so that anyone can read and listen to the amazing stories that we've been collecting. So if you visit our website, assaultcarecenter.org, and hit donate in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the tab Accessing Our History. And on there lives all the stories we've been collecting, upcoming events correlating to Accessing Our History, and just other ways to be involved with our project.
Okay. So like I said, and also like Tess and Courtney explained, this is an oral history project as well as a written project. And we did take a lot of, hear a lot of people's stories here in the studio and recorded them. One of the types of people that we heard, all sorts of people, anywhere from founders to pre-founders to, you know, peripheral helpers to administrators and managers to advocates. And so one of the types of people that did do a lot of the work at Access and still do are the advocates. So can you explain what an advocate means at Access? What is an advocate?
Yeah, an advocate is a person who comes alongside a survivor and supports them as they kind of move through and navigate whatever it is they want to. And that sounds kind of like mushy language, but that's intentionally mushy. You know, as an agency and as an approach, we're really survivor driven. And so what a survivor kind of wants to do, you know, after their experience of trauma, our goal is to help them figure out what that is, because there's something healing about that decision-making process and that choice opportunity, right? And so an advocate's job there is really kind of to be, in some ways, professional friend is what comes to my mind, but they're a systems navigator. They're a wearer of many hats. They're a professional listener, a support system, a champion. And they make sure that they open the doors for survivors that need to be opened is kind of what their main focus is.
Yeah, and the survivor has a number of decisions they have to make relatively quickly. When something happens, they have to decide whether they're willing to go to the hospital. They have to decide whether they'll report to the police, whether they will prosecute eventually, whether they'll tell their family. There's a lot of decisions that they need somebody to guide them through, right?
Exactly, yeah. And it's the, you know, who hasn't had in their own life, you know, had a situation where they had to make really hard decisions. Sometimes you need somebody to hear you out. You need somebody who maybe has a little bit more information, more context about how something works, that they can give you that information in a timely fashion.
Right.
Or somebody who just kind of knows the landscape and can help you navigate it. Those are all super helpful things. And that's what our job is all about.
Yeah, and it's to the credit of the Ames Police Department that historically, way back before really rape was accepted as a legitimate crime, so to speak, the Ames Police Department, when I started the Rape Crisis Center, every time they would get a call that involved sexual assault, they would immediately call me and ask me to come to the police station and involve me as the advocate. And that was really a lot of the foundation upon which all of this started, was the willingness of the Ames Police to bring in somebody and the recognition that somebody else was needed besides a police officer. So we've heard over and over again while we were listening to the stories of advocates, the work that they did there was life-changing for them, and that it was a very deep learning experience for them. So I was wondering if, we talked about bringing some of these voices here to the air, and I think Tess and Courtney have some clips that they want to share with you. And one of the voices we recorded was an advocate named Adam, and we have a clip to share with what he said. Courtney and Tess, can you set up this clip? You know, who was Adam, and what was he explaining in this clip?
So Adam Stark worked with Access from the years 2000 to 2005 as both a shelter intern and a full-time shelter coordinator. So in this clip that we're about to play, Adam talks about learning what it means to be an advocate for survivors of violence.
Okay.
That advocating for her and her getting into housing, like that was just going to be it. I was going to say the right thing and everything was going to be okay. And it's like 20 years later, she's in a really, really bad place. And so it makes me think back to that taking on, is that, like, advocacy is bigger than one person and one person's ability. And that the essential piece of understanding what people see as success in their life is so vitally important for the client, but also for yourself, because it actually takes pressure off of you, because it isn't yours to solve. That takes years to learn. And it helps you in all aspects of your life, how you interact with your family and your friends, and how it impacts your own mental health by being able to do that.
Okay, can you talk a little bit about what Adam was describing?
Yeah, so Adam's just describing that over his time with being an advocate at Access, he just learned that he needs to separate himself, I guess, and let the survivor, let the victim really see for themselves what success is and see what they need, and to make sure he doesn't get his own views and his own versions of success caught up in that, and really learning how to do that.
Okay, thank you. And so Adam was one of the many people who have been advocates at Access. And like we said before, Access is celebrating 45 years this February. So it's celebrating this with Accessing Our History project in partnership with KHOI. And we're speaking with Tess, Cody, and Courtney Palmersheim, who are with Access. Tex is the executive director, and Courtney is the development coordinator and also the producer of the Accessing Our History project that we're kind of exploring today. We're starting to explore. We'll go into this a little bit more during the month. And Adam gave a good description of what he learned about his place as an advocate. We have another clip that you wanted to share, and this is an advocate named Nadia. Could you explain a little bit who Nadia is?
Yeah. So Nadia LaFontaine worked with Access from the years 2012 to 2015 as both a volunteer shelter advocate and a full-time sexual assault advocate and special programs coordinator. In this clip that we're about to play, Nadia explains why it was so important for her to learn how to take care of herself as an advocate.
Okay, here's Nadia.
After I worked my first volunteer shift, I was like, this is it. I figured it out. Like, this is amazing. This is what I want to continue doing. And I'm very fortunate to be able to find that out at a young age. But because I felt I was so in love with it, had so much passion, it tied very closely to me and what I felt was my purpose, I just wanted to do everything and was continuously burning myself out and not able, even though I was told, like, be careful about burnout and you should be able to establish boundaries and don't answer your work cell when you're, you know, not working or on call. And I ignored all of that stuff because I just cared so much. And so that was really difficult. I feel like you kind of either you burn yourself out or you get close enough to it that you recognize it and then you can bring yourself back so that you can maintain. And I kind of had to have a conversation with myself and say, I want to do this long term and how can I sustain myself in it? And so that was difficult. I wanted to do so much and I wanted to make so much right. And you have to recognize, like, you are just human and that this is somebody else's life and things are going to happen and you can't make everything better. You know, you can only make it, I mean, you can make it better, but you can't fix it. And that was difficult. And whether those limitations be because of systems constantly failing survivors or the university or even just their own, like, support system, you know, that was difficult.
And that was Nadia. She is a advocate at Access. And I think Nadia really expressed something that we heard from quite a few people, actually, during the Oral History Project, that, you know, when you talk about it, it's always easy to forget that this is very, very difficult work to do, being an advocate, because you're dealing with some of the most painful aspects of human nature. And I think a lot of people who talk to us, you know, express that they had to experience a lot of failure, or, you know, seeing the people that they were advocating for not have the outcomes that they had hoped for, right? And that it really kind of points to how very, very difficult this work is and how many people have really been willing to engage in it is amazing. Tess and Courtney, do you have any comments about it?
I think you sum it up really well, that is a common theme we heard while talking to people and just the importance of taking care of yourself in order to keep doing this important work.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a real short break and then we'll be back to talk just a little bit more about this project.
We'll be right back.
And this is Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg, here with Tess Cody, who is the Executive Director of Access, and Courtney Palmersheim, who is Development Coordinator. Courtney is also producer for Access's project called Accessing Our History, which is celebrating their 45th anniversary this February, starting today. And we've been playing clips from oral testimonies from people who worked as advocates at Access. And Access and KHOI have been partnering to make some of these recordings. And Nadia and Adam described some of the lessons they've learned from being advocates. Tess and Courtney, what other kind of things did you hear from people who talked about being advocates and what they learned about from working at Access?
Yeah, the stories that we've heard since starting this project are phenomenal and so inspiring. And each person that has dedicated their time and energy to Access has their own unique story to tell. And I would encourage going to check all those out on our website. But some of the other pivotal things I think we heard people say were learning the importance of survivor-centered work, the notion that survivors are people just like you and me, and they know what's best for them. Learning that as an advocate, that you're there just to tell them about their options, but support them on their journey and just empower them to make those decisions for themselves. That's something I think people talked about a lot. And another thing that people mentioned is just explaining that in the anti-violence movement, sometimes you have to fight to be heard, especially 45 years ago when Access was just opening up. You have to fight for what's needed and sometimes face criticism. And some of our storytellers just told us how important it was to learn to keep fighting for survivors and keep fighting for a service that you know is needed. And we'll be sharing more of these stories the next few weeks. So I'm really excited about that.
Well, that's beautiful. Thank you, Courtney. Tess, you're the executive director of Access, but you yourself have been an advocate. Tell us a little bit about your journey as an advocate at the center.
It's been actually really good, affirming to listen to some of these stories, because definitely a lot of, I think, thematic aha moments in my career as well. You know, when I think about, especially when I think about early Tess, young Tess as an advocate, I think one of the lessons I needed to learn was just that real listening is hard. And, you know, it's so easy to like listen to somebody to respond, especially when you're anxious and the story you're hearing feels high stakes. It's so easy to just want to be like, you know, listen so that I can respond to the thing that they're saying. But that's not necessarily what people need. What they need is somebody who really just sits with them in whatever the moment is and really hears them out before even worrying about the response part. That can come, and you will find your words when you need to have that response piece there. But that kind of authenticity that comes from real deep listening, that is a gift that we don't often give each other in this country. And it takes a lot of practice to get good at it. So that's definitely been one thing that I've learned, and I'm not sure that I'm fully perfect at it, to be fully honest. I think work in progress on there. But I think another thing that has come to, that's been a learning process, is just that dignity matters. And I have seen a lot of survivors make choices that on the outside seem like, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you take this option over here? You know, like that kind of classic question of like, why doesn't he just leave, or some of those sorts of questions. When I get to the heart of those, it's because for a lot of survivors, it comes down to dignity, that wasn't what they wanted their life to be like. That's not what they wanted to be treated like. And so of course they didn't, like, if you center that dignity and respect for that survivor matter, then you would never choose some of the options that people might be trying to push or think are best for somebody. And I think that for me, like when I realized, like, whatever my agenda or my hangups about what like a good life could be got set aside, I was a better advocate. You know, I was better at really, again, really seeing people. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. It's beautiful to hear kind of your own development. I think for me, one of the most profound lessons that I took away from being advocate, you know, situation of sexual assault and abuse, was that the, you know, that somebody even speaking up and telling me about it was a first act of power. And, you know, power is really what is needed. You know, that the survivor of an event like that is struggling to regain a sense of power, and just being able to tell somebody is a first act of power. And I don't think I respected the power of that until I became an advocate, that just talking to each other is really the beginning of healing, right? Well, thank you. We've kind of explored a little bit what an advocate is. Before we end our conversation, is there anything kind of bigger that you feel that you've learned so far by doing this history project? What's your takeaway so far from it?
It's kind of funny that Tess, you mentioned this thing about listening, because that's what I've learned, that everybody has a story to tell, and sometimes they just need the chance to be heard. They just need to be asked. And the story has reminded me to do that and to give people the opportunity to tell their story. And I think I've also gained just a deep appreciation for the people who saw the gap in Ames 45 years ago and did something about it. Ursula, I'm looking at you. What you guys did 45 years ago is so amazing. And I've just really learned to appreciate that.
Thank you, Courtney. Tess, any thoughts?
I think that kind of what your last statement there, just that like power in that first conversation, I think a theme for me has just been being brave, being bold on the part of survivors is always worth it. And that every time somebody in this community, whether that's you at the founding or folks at our agency who've made some kind of bold decisions at different times, have chosen that path of it's always paid out, and it's been hard, but the fight is worth it. And I think that energizes me kind of for the fights that we have today.
Yeah, I really, in hearing these testimonies, I just really heard how difficult this work has been and how many people have applied themselves just in a very, very committed way. Very, very impressive to hear what people have done. Again, if you've just joined us, we're talking about the Accessing Our History Project of Access, the local, or really the regional at this point, rape crisis and domestic violence support center. And we're with Tess Cody, who's the executive director, and Courtney Palmersheim, who's the development director. Tell us again, Courtney, how somebody can find this information online. I guess both Facebook and...
Yeah, first make sure...
Facebook and website, right?
Yep. First make sure to follow our Facebook page. It's at Assault Care Center. We'll be sharing short snippets and stories over there for the next 45 days. And then our project also lives on our website, assaultcarecenter.org. So check it out there as well.
And you'll be posting some of the testimonials there, right?
Yeah, yep.
Okay, yeah, and we'll link to that on our website too. Now, of course, the all-important question at the end of the day, the most important question is that if someone needs help from Access, how do they connect with you?
Yeah, if someone needs help, they can call one of our 24/7 helplines. I'll go ahead and list them now. Our sexual abuse line is 515-292-5378. Our domestic abuse and homicide violent crimes line is 515-292-0519. And our housing line is 515-292-0543. Those lines are 24/7. And we also have a live chat that operates 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Monday through Friday. So it's like chatting online. And that's found on our website in the upper right-hand corner.
So someone might not have had time to write down all those numbers. Can the numbers be found on your website?
Yep. They're, I think, right at the bottom of the of our website.
Okay, thank you. Why don't you run by those numbers again real quickly?
Yep, sexual abuse, 515-292-5378. Domestic abuse and homicide violent crimes, 515-292-0519. And housing, 515-292-0543.
And this is a confidential service, right?
Free and confidential, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and finally, if somebody wants to donate to Access, where do they go?
Yeah, so you can donate to the Accessing Our History campaign by visiting our website again, assaultcarecenter.org, clicking donate in the upper right-hand corner, and clicking the Accessing Our History silver donate button. And you can also mail checks to P.O. Box 1429, Ames, Iowa 50014.
Okay. Thank you for coming, both of you, Tess Cody and Courtney Palmerjean.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure to partner with Access to celebrate this 45th anniversary. And we're going to continue this story here on Local Talk for the next two Mondays. So stay tuned on Mondays. It's a great and proud local success story to enjoy. And you'll be sharing some more clips and some more aspects of what has come out in this oral history project. So thank you for joining us this morning, and we'll see you again next Monday. And you've been listening to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg. Beginning this evening at 7 p.m., KHOI is pleased to introduce a new program called Capital Week, which will feature Laura Bellin, author of the blog Bleeding Heartland, and will be hosted by KHOI's newsman, Dennis Hart. Ms. Bellin will provide updates on developments at the Iowa State Capitol every Monday night with an in-depth look at the week's legislative actions, government agencies, the governor, and other events that affect Iowa government. Laura has been called one of Iowa's most outstanding and hardest-working political reporters, and Dennis Hart has been reporting on local news and state news for KHOI for more than 3 years, volunteering his services in his retirement after spending a lifetime reporting news for both radio and television and teaching journalism in various places around the country, including the Greenlee School of Journalism at Iowa State. And KHOI will be filling out the rest of the hour from 7:30 to 8 with reports and forums from other civic organizations such as the League of Women Voters, Story County in Ames, and the Iowa NAACP. So we will expand our partnerships with these organizations to air their forums and presentations. Tonight we'll begin with the League of Women Voters of Story County and Ames legislative updates. So check in our exciting new offering here at KHOI. And speaking of exciting offerings, Anna Banana is in the house. Hi, Anna.
Hello. Yes, it is Monday, and thank you, Ursula, for that really wonderful Local Talk program today. So today I have a message. So this is the week that my stepfather passed away last year, and I know that you've experienced loss as well, Ursula. And so for all those that have experienced loss, this heart-to-heart message is dedicated to each of you. But I'm going to start with a poem about birth that my friend in England sent to me, titled Born. Born, never to have been born at all, some people say, but he was not properly born till she was two. People are born on this or that particular day, and any one of them might have been me or you. But who she or he were at the moment of birth is now impossible to know. Anything might have happened, and now what is it worth? Not as much as the next day might bring. I am who I am because you exist. I can't define a self that is not also you. You are the air in my lungs. You are my heart and spine. You're not just sitting there, you're everywhere. So he declared, we are embedded in time and put down ever deeper roots in you and I. The soil will shift around us to unrhyme this verse, but though we're bound to fly, earth, we fly. And then at the same time, so we start with birth and thus heart-to-heart message, but my stepsister sent this heart-to-heart message to end with the ending of the cycle of life. Death is nothing at all. It does not count. I've only slipped away into the next room. Nothing has happened. Everything remains exactly as it was. I am I, and you are you, and the old life that we live so fondly together is untouched, unchanged. Whatever we were to each other, that we are still. Call me by the old familiar name. Speak of me in the easy way which you always used, but no difference into your tone. Wear no forced air of solemnness or sorrow. Laugh as we always laughed at the little jokes that we enjoyed together. Play, smile, think of me, pray for me. Let my name be ever the household word that it always was. Let it be spoken without an effort, without the ghost of a shadow upon it. Life means all that it ever meant. It is the same as it ever was. There is absolute and unbroken continuity. What is this death but an inexorable accident? Why should I be out of mind because I am out of sight? I am but waiting for you for an interval, somewhere very near, just around the corner, all is well. And so that is one of my heart-to-heart messages, starting with birth and death. And I'm not sure, Ursula, but if you have another moment, I do have another heart-to-heart message, but I'm not sure about the timing, so you let me know.
I think we're okay.
All right, well, let me read this one. So this is called A 20 Crumpled Dollar Bills. So my wife teaches piano lessons to kids and adults. One day, a young man called to ask about lessons. He explained that he was living in his car, but really missed playing the piano. It was something he'd done until mental illness took hold and his life unraveled. He couldn't afford her usual fee, he said, but he promised to pay her $20 for the money he panhandled on the street, and she readily agreed. Every week he showed up right in time, usually with 20 crumpled $1 bills in his pocket, which he'd count one by one. In the spring, he'd always sometimes bring her berries he'd pick in a local park. He played very well and rarely missed a lesson. And my wife would always give him a sandwich and a piece of fruit when he left. Then one day he stopped showing up, didn't call, nothing, just vanished. That was about 10 years ago. Last year, he called one day out of the blue to say he'd moved across the country, remarried, and had a new baby. He was working and saving some money for a piano. And the reason why I picked that heart-to-heart message is that we never know what we can do with 20 crumpled bills or just a random act of kindness. And I think today's show, we can do that by going to Access website and making a donation and participating in that program, listening to KHOI, and just having a kind word for somebody as we start our February, the month of love and all that is February, which I can't believe it's February.
I know. Well, thank you, Anna. It's good to hear your messages, yes, and random acts of kindness. And you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg, and Anna Banana is here with us. And thank you for listening in today. Remember that you can also hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and the information you heard on the program, and we'll list the phone numbers as well for getting help from Access. And again, a reminder that tonight at 7 p.m. is the beginning of our new show called Capital Week, featuring Laura Bellin and Dennis Hart. And I'm excited to see how that goes here at KHOI. This show was engineered by Michael Murphy. Thank you, Michael. And thank you, Anna, for being on the show. And remember that you, the listener, are what really makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Without you, we're just a bunch of smart people in a room. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.